What's up, crime crew? Welcome to Murder Unscripted's Forensic Fridays. Every other Friday, we bring you a bite-sized dose of true crime. These episodes are shorter than our full-length episodes that drop on Tuesday, but packed with the same jaw-dropping chaos and deadly detail. I'm Melissa, and today I'm going to share with you the incredibly tragic case of the murder of Shannon Melendi. So for this installment of MU's Forensic Fridays, I need to take you back to my favorite decade, the 1990s, specifically March of 1994. And our case today centers around the abduction and murder of 19-year-old Shannon Denise Melendi. Shannon was enrolled as a dual major in Spanish and political science at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. And according to her friends, her plans after graduation included joining the Navy and attending law school. Eventually, she wanted to be a Supreme Court justice. This girl had big dreams, and I really feel like she had the drive to achieve all of them. So Saturday, March 26, 1994 was a beautiful spring day in Atlanta, Georgia, and Shannon was scheduled to work her part-time job at the Softball Country Club. This club's no longer around, but it was a large sportsplex that hosted adult softball leagues, and on this Saturday in particular, there was a really big tournament going on. So Shannon was scheduled to keep score, and she got there at about 8:40 a.m. Around 12:40 p.m. that same day, Shannon left the club for her lunch break. However, when the next game began, Shannon wasn't there. Both she and her score pad were missing, and sadly, she's never been seen again. Despite hundreds of people being at that ball field, no one had any idea where she could have gone. And it would take 10 long years for Shannon's killer to be brought to justice. And even more frustrating, as of this recording, Shannon's remains have yet to be recovered. This was actually a landmark case in Georgia, as it was the first no-body case. And the real ones will know that's a throwback to June 2024, when Murder Unscripted first started, and our first couple episodes were about no-body crimes. So what happened that warm spring day in March of 1994? Well, I want to start out by telling you about this incredible young woman at the center of our case. Shannon Denise Melendi was born on October 20th, 1974, in Miami, Florida, to proud parents Louis and Yvonne Melendi. A few years later, the family welcomed Shannon's little sister, Monique, who Shannon absolutely adored. And there was a 5-year age difference between the girls, but that really didn't seem to matter as they were super close. And actually, the whole Melendi family was really, really close. Shannon was a total daddy's girl, and Yvonne talked about how she had her dad just completely wrapped around her finger. And Shannon and Monique had a really special sisterly bond, with Monique saying, quote, "I idolized my big sister. She was my very own personal superhero. She was smart and witty and somehow always managed to get me out of trouble with our parents," end quote, which I thought was really, really sweet. I don't have a ton of information about Shannon's early childhood, but she grew up to be such a badass young woman. And like, this girl had a plan. I already touched on it a little. It included joining the Navy, law school, and ultimately becoming a Supreme Court justice. And again, I feel like she would have absolutely met these goals. I mean, just listen to everything this girl had already done in the 19 years she was on Earth. She graduated in the top 3% of her class from Miami South High School, where she had been the class president for her junior and senior year. Shannon was a superstar, and she was incredibly well-rounded. Not only was she a talented athlete and shined on the school soccer team, but Shannon was also captain of her school's debate team, and she was an incredibly gifted public speaker, which I feel like is insanely cool and badass all in itself. But those public speaking skills really came in handy when, in her senior year of high school, this brave chick spoke in front of the U.S. Congress and the United Nations. There's no way I could have done that in my high school years or even now, but Shannon wasn't afraid, and she went after what she wanted, and she went after her goals, and she met them. After she graduated high school, Shannon had been accepted into several prestigious universities, including Georgetown and American University. But she had ultimately decided on Emory University in Atlanta. And this meant that Shannon would be about 700 miles from home, which her parents weren't exactly pumped about, but like they also understood that Shannon needed her independence. In addition to working part-time at the softball country club and taking classes full-time with a double major, no less, Shannon had also scored a super prestigious paid internship at the Carter Center. And if you aren't sure what that is, don't feel bad because I didn't know it either. So I looked it up, and the Carter Center was founded in 1982 by former President Jimmy Carter and his wife, Rosalind Carter. And it's this nonprofit organization that works around the world to promote peace, fight disease, and improve human rights. So, needless to say, Shannon was well on her way to achieving success. So, what on earth happened, and how did this beautiful young woman's life end so tragically? Well, we talked about how she was working at the softball field the day she disappeared, and no one really raised the alarm right away when Shannon didn't return to work that afternoon, but later that night, her roommate, Astina, began to worry. Shannon hadn't returned to their dorm room, which was very strange. And remember, this is 1994, so this is long before cell phones were like in everyday use. So unfortunately, Athena didn't really have many options in regard to contacting Shannon. And then the next morning, when Shannon still wasn't back, Athena knew something was up. So at this point, Athena begins calling around, asking friends if anyone had seen Shannon. She called a couple other friends, and she even called Shannon's parents' house. And her parents were working, so 13-year-old Monique answered the phone, and she immediately knew something was wrong. Like, she could just hear that panic in Athena's voice. So Athena explained the situation, and Monique told her that she would begin making calls to family members who lived near Emory University in hopes that maybe Shannon had gone to visit a relative, and, you know, there's a totally reasonable explanation for everything. In the meantime, Athena and a couple friends decide to drive to the softball country club and just to see if Shannon was there or if anybody there had seen her. As they made the 20-ish minute drive, Athena missed the turn to pull into the softball club, so she drove a little bit further until she found a place to turn around, and that's when she saw it. Sitting abandoned in a gas station parking lot was Shannon's beloved black Nissan. When the friends got out to investigate the car, they realized that it was not only unlocked, but the keys were in the ignition. And this was really strange. Shannon absolutely loved this car. Like, there is no way in hell that she would have just left it at a random gas station, especially unlocked and the keys right there. But something else that was super telling, the faceplate of Shannon's radio was still attached to the radio. And for anyone who doesn't know what I'm talking about, in the 90s, you could get like a stereo sound system installed in your car, and it would have a removable faceplate, which would attach to the unit. And because these radios were expensive and like a hot commodity at the time, they were often stolen. But if you removed the faceplate and took it with you, there wouldn't be much of a point in stealing the entire radio system because it wouldn't work. So Shannon would have never left this faceplate still attached to the dashboard. She would have taken it with her. So Athena and friends immediately called police, and this is where things start really going downhill. And I am not trying to bash these officers involved, but there were some pretty big missteps at the beginning of the investigation. An officer did come out to the gas station where the car was found, but as soon as the officer heard Athena's story, like about her 19-year-old roommate going missing, the officer pretty much immediately decided that Shannon was just some college kid off partying somewhere and she would turn up. And this officer refused to even entertain the notion of foul play. Especially because after like a real quick glance at the vehicle, nothing about the car indicated a struggle. So this officer refused to inspect the car, refused to dust it for fingerprints, and refused to process it. And Athena tried to tell this officer that Shannon wouldn't just take off. She wasn't that type of kid, but the officer had no interest in hearing what Athena had to say. And in a move that would almost destroy Shannon's case, this police officer told Athena and friends to take the car home. So Athena and the friends get back to campus with Shannon's car, and they called the Melendi home again, and they explained what happened. And understandably, Lewis and Yvonne were not only upset and concerned about their daughter, but They were also really upset with the police for allowing them to just take Shannon's car. Like, her parents knew that any potential evidence that could have been left behind in that vehicle was now compromised and basically useless. So with that, Lewis and Yvonne packed up and headed to Atlanta. And when they arrived, they went right to the police station and spoke with officers. And they were pretty much given the same treatment that Athena had gotten. Like, the police didn't really take Shannon's disappearance seriously. They just kept telling the Melendis that Shannon would turn up. And they really doubled down on this theory when they found out that Shannon had recently been on spring break. She and some friends had gone to Panama City, Florida, and police kind of theorized that Shannon had met someone on spring break and just decided to run away with them. And of course, Shannon's family and friends just scoffed at this idea. They thought it was ridiculous. But since police weren't taking Shannon's disappearance seriously, the family and the friends and other classmates, they had to kind of figure it out on their own for a little bit. So they hung up missing posters all over the town. They also alerted the media, and Lewis and Yvonne did as many media appearances as possible. Like, they were just desperate to find out what happened to their little girl. Luckily, the Melendis had some pretty powerful connections, like not only their own connections, but also through Shannon's internship at the Carter Center. So the family was actually able to get the FBI involved, and they began looking into Shannon's case. And it wasn't too long after they got involved that the local PD was like, oh, guess we better get on board for this. Especially after the FBI was able to determine that Shannon's disappearance had nothing to do with the spring break trip. So about 10 days after Shannon went missing, the counseling center at Emory University received a really strange phone call. It was an unknown male who was on the line saying that he had abducted Shannon, but that she was safe. And he stated that he would release her when he was done with her. And a few sources mentioned that he said he would make his demands known, like some sort of ransom. The call was really quick, but before he hung up, he told the operator that he would leave something behind that belonged to Shannon. Police were able to track the call to a payphone outside of a Waffle House, and they raced to the payphone, but unfortunately, the caller was long gone by the time they got there. So they began looking around, and on the ground beneath the phone was this little bag. And in the shows I watched, it looked kind of like a little canvas drawstring bag. And inside of that was a ring. The ring had been wrapped in masking tape, and when they finally got all the tape off, it was a blue topaz ring that was ultimately determined to be Shannon's. And this ring had meant a great deal to Shannon, as her godmother had given it to her when she was in high school. She wore this ring all the time, and she never would have left it behind willingly. This call may have kind of been the final push that police needed to agree that Shannon didn't run away. Like, even though they were on board, I think they were a little hesitant. So this call left a lot of questions. A lot of people wondered, is Shannon still alive? Her family really, really hoped that she was. Police weren't really sure. So the next move for investigators was to begin tracking down every single person who had been at that softball field the day Shannon was last seen. And like I mentioned earlier, there was a tournament going on that day, and there were at least 25 different teams playing. So that meant that investigators ended up interviewing somewhere between 400 and 500 people. And there was one common theme that kept coming up in all of these interviews, and it was about one of the softball game umpires, a man named Colvin Hinton, who went by Butch. So according to a lot of the people that they interviewed, it was Butch's antics that seemed to garner more attention than the actual softball games. Not only the players, but the spectators also told police that Butch seemed to be obsessed with the young woman keeping score, who we all know was Shannon Melendi. Apparently, Butch wouldn't even be watching the game. He was like too busy trying to chat up Shannon, and he's basically making game decisions pretty much on a whim. One of the pitchers was interviewed on an episode of Forensic Files, and he was irate that Butch was making calls without actually seeing the play. So with so many reports surfacing about the weird umpire, police decided to have a chat with Butch. And when they tracked him down, they discovered that Butch was a local man in his early 30s. So gross that he was hitting on a 19-year-old, but anyway. He was married, and he was employed as an airplane mechanic for Delta Airlines. He seemed like a pretty normal dude, and he was known to be very active in his church, even teaching Sunday school, which is terrifying that you never know who's teaching your kids. It should be noted, his father was the pastor at the church that he was really active in. So when police spoke with Butch, he said he hadn't spoken to Shannon at the game. He didn't know anything about where she went afterwards. And investigators were kind of suspicious of Butch when his story about what he did after the game began to change. However, he claimed he went home and made several phone calls. So police looked into his phone records and they confirmed that he had made several calls from his home's landline. So police still didn't have a good feeling about Butch, but unfortunately, they really didn't have anything to hold him. So while all of this is going on, the phone call and the interviews with everyone at the field, Shannon's friends and family are just continuing to search for her. They're looking high and low everywhere they can. They had put together a $10,000 reward, and in addition to covering the town with her missing poster, they even took it a step further and put that missing poster on dozens of billboards around the Atlanta area. Police were still uneasy about Butch, and they began to look into him in a little bit more, and it turns out they were right to think something wasn't quite right. Colvin Butch Hinton was a sexual predator. In 1977, when he was 17 years old, he assaulted and tied up his boss's wife. He admitted that he had been trying to rape her, but due to his age, he was treated as a juvenile and his punishment was psychiatric treatment. Then in 1982, he lured his brother's ex-girlfriend to a location where he proceeded to kidnap her at knife point and molest her. This poor girl was only 14 years old. And yet again, Butch basically got away with it. He was sentenced to 4 years in prison and ended up serving 15 months. What a joke. So based on his changing stories about what happened after the game and his criminal record, police were able to get a search warrant for his home. So on April 12, 1994, investigators searched his home and they even brought cadaver dogs, but they couldn't find a single trace of Shannon. And at this point, unfortunately, her case kind of goes cold and her parents had to go back to Miami without Shannon. So fast forward a few months later, on September 8th, 1994, a fire broke out at the home of Butch Hinton and his wife. And it was eventually determined to be arson, but we'll get back to that in just a minute. So while police were investigating the fire, they happened to speak to Hinton's neighbors, who told them that the night that Shannon disappeared, Hinton had a bonfire in his backyard burn pit. Well, this information was enough for police to get another search warrant for the home. But this time, they dug up the fire pit, and while they still didn't find any traces of Shannon, what they did find was incredibly unsettling. They unearthed several women's sweaters, and they were all in very petite sizes, which meant that none of the sweaters belonged to his wife, and it was determined none of them belonged to Shannon. When Hinton was asked about it, he denied knowing anything about the sweaters, had no idea how they got there. They must have been there when he bought them. But the sweaters weren't the only thing they had found during the search. Also in that burn pit, investigators discovered wire zip ties and cleaning supplies. Then they found a whole bunch of masking tape in Hinton's garage. Remember, Shannon's ring had been wrapped up in a whole bunch of masking tape. At this point, Hinton had other problems though. He had actually been arrested for insurance fraud. And this was because they discovered he had set the fire in his own home. So in 1996, Colvin Butch Hinton was sentenced to 9 years in prison. We all just take note of the fact that he got a longer sentence for insurance fraud than he did for the kidnapping and attempted rape of that 14-year-old girl and the boss's wife too. Gotta love that American justice system, right? So Hinton goes off to jail, and in the meantime, Shannon's brokenhearted family, they attempt to find some sense of normalcy. And her parents are in the Forensic Files episode and the Dateline episode, and it is very clear that their worlds just really ended the day that Shannon went missing. So now we need to fast forward again, this time until 2003. And it's shortly before Hinton was set to be released from prison. There were these two prosecutors, John Petrie and Michael McDaniel, and they became super interested in Shannon's case. And after reviewing the files, they both strongly believed that Hinton was the culprit, and they did not want him back out walking among the population. They knew that he was going to strike again. It was just a matter of time. So Petrie and McDaniel decided to look into it further, and they received the case files and evidence boxes from the FBI. And one of the first things they did was look at that little bag that Shannon's ring had been found in. It didn't take them very long to determine not only the manufacturer, but also where the bags were sold. And they discovered that these bags were bought and used by Delta Airlines. Remember who worked for Delta? Colvin Butch Hinton. These bags were apparently used to send small engine parts for repair. And remember all that masking tape that was found in Hinton's garage after the fire? Well, the prosecutors compared the tape wrapped around the ring, and it was exact match to the tape found in the garage. Then, while they had submitted the masking tape for testing at the lab used an infrared spectrometer, and they were able to see small specks of metal stuck in the tape's adhesive. So they looked closer. It turns out these little metal particles were very unique due to this tungsten cobalt alloy they used. And it just so happened that Delta Airlines used this exact alloy to cover engine parts. Colvin Butch Hinton was released from his insurance fraud prison sentence on December 18th, 2003. On August 30th, 2004, he was arrested for the murder of 19-year-old Shannon Melendi. The trial began in August of 2005, and while Hinton maintained his innocence, the jury did not buy it. They deliberated for 3 days, and their decision? Colvin Hinton was found guilty of murdering Shannon Melendi. Then, in September of 2005, he was sentenced to life in prison. However, due to much looser sentencing laws back in 1994 when the murder was committed, there was a chance that he could be paroled after serving only 7 years. 7 years for murdering this beautiful young woman. Ridiculous. So Hinton would start filing appeals. You know, he's still claiming he didn't kill Shannon. However, in July of 2006, after his final appeal was denied, Hinton finally confessed to killing Shannon and told investigators what actually happened that warm spring day in March of 1994. This next part's a little rough, so skip ahead about a minute or so if you don't want to hear this. Hinton explained that he had convinced Shannon to get lunch with him on that lunch break, so they decided to go to a local Burger King in his car. After lunch, while they were driving back to the field, Hinton faked a wrong turn and he ended up getting on the highway where, unknown to Shannon, they were heading towards his house. Then, for some reason, Hinton decided to fake a leg cramp and told Shannon he couldn't drive and he needed her to drive. So Shannon complied, but as soon as she got in the driver's seat, he pulled a knife on her and instructed her to drive as he gave her directions to his home. He then forced her inside, upstairs to his bedroom, where he tied poor Shannon to a bedpost. It was at this point when Hinton began making all those phone calls, which would later help him establish an alibi. Then, with Shannon still held captive up in the bedroom, he just left the house. He returned to the ball field, he got Shannon's car and drove it to the gas station where it would be found the next day. And don't forget, Hinton was supposed to return to the field as he was scheduled to umpire another game. But he called a friend and he asked the friend to cover for him because, as he explained, he had a, quote, hot date. He's a disgusting monster. So after ditching Shannon's car, he returned home and he proceeded to rape Shannon for hours. At some point that night, he left her tied up and he went to the movies with his niece, nephew, and their parents. They went to see The Mighty Ducks 2. This asshole is sitting there watching Emilio Estevez as poor Shannon is tied up, desperately trying to get free. Again, he's a monster. When Hinton returned home, he continued to sexually assault Shannon for hours. At some point, he went to sleep, but then woke up around 2 a.m. And this is when he manually strangled Shannon and then burned her body in that burn pit in the backyard. And again, as of this recording, no evidence of Shannon's remains have ever been found. So Hinton first became eligible for parole in 2012, and Shannon's poor family was forced to relive her murder while they fought for this monster to be kept behind bars. Thankfully, parole was denied, but he was eligible again just recently in February of 2025. And as far as I can tell, this was denied as well, and there is a change.org petition that the family started to keep Colvin Hinton behind bars. I signed it. I will absolutely include the link so you can sign it too. This disgusting monster absolutely does not deserve to walk among us. There is no rehabilitation for people like him, and there is no way he should get out of jail ever. Sadly, the Melende family would suffer yet another tragedy in 2021 when Yvonne passed away from COVID-related pneumonia. This entire case is such a bummer, and what sucks the most is that Shannon's death could have totally been avoided had the justice system not let her down. There was just failure after failure, you know, starting with a piss-poor excuse for justice regarding the attempted rape when Hinton was 17, and then the sexual molestation of the 14-year-old girl just a few years later. Had he actually been held accountable and held in prison for longer, Shannon might still be alive. She was failed there, and then I feel like she was failed again when police refused to take her disappearance seriously. Let's not forget how they just let Shannon's friends take her car home without any sort of forensic processing. Shannon deserves so much more, and I truly believe that the world is a darker place not having her in it. I would love to hear your thoughts on Shannon's case. You can hit us up on our socials at Murder Unscripted. You can shoot us an email at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. And if you want to start a conversation, join us over on our Reddit page, Murder Unscripted. Thank you so much for joining me. That's all I got for this week's installment of MU's Forensic Friday mini-sode. So join us on Tuesday for another full-length episode. Our theme this month is paranormal forensics. So until next time, stay safe, stay curious, stay unscripted.